Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally, 7 days a week here in the United States, and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Social Security when we return. If you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets 60%. That's a 60-40 split. That's about $20,000 for you, $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of special? But if you're not happy with your share, and you think that that's not enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year. And you're going to net about 25%, and the government's going to net about 75%, which means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, or about 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. Now, that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS, of course. And that's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much for so little received. Let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School. It's now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Now, to order that free general law CD package, just call direct and order yours today. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, President George Bush has taken on Social Security now that he's been reelected for his second term. If you'll remember, he said that he wanted to reform Social Security in his first administration. He didn't do very much about Social Security that first time around. I guess he was heeding the political advice that says Social Security is the third rail of politics, going back to Barry Goldwater in 1964, that said, remember, Goldwater said that Social Security needed to be reformed. And of course, the Democrats who came up with the idea back in 1935, Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal, they claim that the Republicans just want to abolish Social Security. I don't want to abolish Social Security. I think it's wonderful, and I think people that want to participate in Social Security should. My objection to Social Security has been its mandatory compulsion that I didn't care too much for. I opted out of the system back in 1984. I would have opted out earlier if I'd have known how. It took me a while to figure out how to get the hell out. I don't want to abolish Social Security. I think that Social Security belongs to all those good folks out there that want it, that freedom of choice is an important aspect of life, and that you ought to have the right to make the wrong choices as well as the right choices. But Social Security, they tell us, is in crisis. They tell us it's upside down. It's going bankrupt. Jimmy Carter told us that. And they raised taxes in Carter's administration to save Social Security. 4 years later, President Reagan came along and he said, Social Security is in crisis, and there has to be a solution to the problem. And so they solved the problem again, and they raised taxes again. I did a little research on Social Security. I thought this week I'll bring you that report. Social Security has needed more and more money from the time that it was created. In 1951, the Social Security's maximum tax rate was 2.25%. Today, it's 16.1%. 15.3% if you're self-employed. And this money that goes to Social Security is paid out to 50 million recipients every month. Now, it's true, there's a little surplus in the Social Security program right now, but that surplus will be exhausted by the year 2018. Now, we're just talking about another 13 years, and that's going to be exhausted. So then we either have to raise taxes or cut benefits. Now, cutting benefits is about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party, so nobody wants to do that. So they have raised the retirement age to 67 or so for people that are going to retire in years to come. But there's a baby boom generation coming on. 76 million new retirees are going to be going into the system over the next 20 years. The first will start retiring 5 years from now. And, of course, when you start retiring, you only live for 10 years. That's the average. So the people that start retiring, and you've got these baby boomers for about 20 years. So you know, just add 5 years, and that's about 2010, then just go out there to about 2032, and the Social Security system not only will be financially exhausted, it'll have a debt of $4 trillion on top of it. Now, that's in today's dollars, and of course, as inflation continues over the next 30 years, you know, it'll probably be 10 times greater than that, or some astronomical number out here, you know, like Google or something. So what's the solution to Social Security? Well, Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of the Treasury, was on Tucker Carlson the other night. Happened to catch him. It was on Friday night, I think it was. Paul O'Neill said that Social Security is a welfare scheme that steals from people. And I thought that was kind of strange. I've been telling you that I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 70 years. And all of a sudden, here comes Paul O'Neill, walks up to the plate, and he says Social Security is bankrupt. Social Security is a welfare scheme. Social Security is not fiscally responsible, and that it's going broke, and it's a Ponzi scheme. And when he got all through, I said, well, now that's the first time I've heard a politician step up to the plate and say something intelligent. So I'm going to have to quit saying, you know, that I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in 70 years. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. Larry McDonald used to say things that were kind of intelligent. And once in a while, you know, we'll hear some representative off in some corner of the House of Representatives say something that's intelligent. So let me tell you, though, that it's pretty rare, isn't it? Spiker came out with an article the other day. I thought I'd share that with you, and we'll take a look at the origin of the Social Security thing, and then let's take a look at it and see, well, do you really think that you ought to belong to Social Security? And if you do, do you think you ought to stay in there? And I wouldn't tell you that you should get out of Social Security, but I think that if you see the numbers and see the facts and the amount of money that you're paying in for what you're going to get out of it and what you could get out of a private annuity, which is about 10 times more than you're going to get from Social Security, I think that it would make more sense. And that's what Paul O'Neill said. He said, you know, these private accounts that the president's talking about over here don't go far enough. That what you need to do is abolish Social Security totally, let people take that money and invest it at 5% interest just in U.S. government bonds, and they'd do 10 times better than they're going to do. In fact, he said every one of them would come out, or nearly all of them, not everyone, but nearly all of them would come out with $1 million retirement in today's dollars at 5% interest. I'm going to show you that they're exactly right. If you took that same 16%, now he was using the number 12, he said just let these people have that 12%, let them invest it, you know, in U.S. government or treasury bills or stock market or real estate or whatever the hell they want. And if they took that 12%, not 16, just 12% of the 16% that you're now paying, why, you'd all be millionaires by the time you retire. And he's exactly right, and I'll show you those numbers. That's what I did some years ago, and I'm just happy as a clam at high tide with my decision. Now, $44 trillion abyss is what the title of this article is. It comes from Spiker. It's dated 123, so it's not too old. It's here in January 2005. It's from Fortune Business News and Financial News, Fortune Magazine. The $44 trillion abyss by Anna Bernasek. The baby boomers are about to retire, and it's going to cost us big. And here's what the government doesn't want you to know. Just how much is $44 trillion? Well, it's more than four times the total gross domestic product of the United States. That's everything that every American produces in a year, then multiply that times four. It would buy three Hummer H2s for every person in the United States. Or it's about 1,500 times the personal fortune of Bill Gates. Last fall, Paul O'Neill, then Secretary of the Treasury, wanted a simple answer to a thorny question. How prepared was the nation today to pay all of its future bills? Two government experts worked for months to calculate the answer, and their findings, which shocked them, have never been published. The Bush administration made sure of that. They wouldn't allow it. The reason for the silence was that by the time the two researchers had completed their study, O'Neill had been thrown out of the Treasury and replaced by the more politically astute John Snow. No savvy administration power player would dare point out right in the middle of tax cut season that there was a huge hole in the country's finances. In fact, it's a $44 trillion hole. Now, that's the kind of Washington tactic that makes Larry Kotlikoff very angry. So angry, in fact, that the normally composed and carefully spoken academic starts ranting about a government conspiracy to keep us all in the dark. He even refers to this particular episode as the Great Treasury Cover-Up, and once you start Kotlikoff on the subject, it's hard to get him stopped. I hate politicians, he says, without pausing for a breath. These people are so focused on the next election, they don't care about the next generation. And the thing that really turns my stomach is that they have the opportunity to do good, and they know they're doing bad, and it's okay. It's immoral. Well, the first massive wave of baby boomer retirees will hit about 5 years from now, and that will leave fewer workers to pay for ballooning Social Security and Medicare bills. Now, how the expected budget shortfall of $44.2 trillion breaks down is this. Social Security, $7 trillion, Medicare, $36.6 trillion, other, 6-tenths of a trillion. Now, based on current government revenue and spending, and these sources now come from the Census Bureau, Smetters and Gookhale, Kotlikoff isn't some soft-headed liberal, ivory tower type. It's true his Boston office does resemble a tower, or at least a turret, with rounded windows overlooking the Charles River and with a view across it to those two bastions of economic thought. That's Harvard and MIT. But Kotlikoff is a mathematically minded mainstream economist who heads the economics department at Boston University, and he has also taken on the role of fiscal crusader. At last count, he had written 11 books, 66 chapters, 80 journal articles, and 37 op-ed pieces about our financial mess here in the United States. 2 decades ago, Kotlikoff, who's now 52, pondered the impact of the baby boom generation and the impact that it was going to have once it retired. He realized the government had a looming financial crisis on its hands because in calculating its budget, it considered only current year Medicare and Social Security payouts. It ignored its massive future obligations. Now that means, as absurd as this may sound, that the government does not know how much it owes in total. And a government that doesn't know what it owes has no way to judge whether or not it can pay. So in the mid-1980s, Kotlikoff pioneered a new way of accounting that could do the math, and it quickly won the approval of his profession. Now, jargon-loving economists call it generational accounting. Kotlikoff's work revealed the sheer enormity of the financial hole that the government is facing. Back then, it all seemed a long way off, but today, with the first baby boomers reaching retirement age in just 5 years, this message has taken on new urgency, and in the intervening years, he's been writing books, testifying before Congress, and doing everything that he can to get the message out. But still, nothing has been done to resolve the problem. In fact, the way Kotlikoff sees it, we're making matters worse. Now, before you dismiss Kotlikoff as a lonely prophet of doom, let's get back to that government report that never saw the light of day. The authors of the report, Kent Smetters and Jagadish Gokhale, had intimate knowledge of Kotlikoff's work. Smetters had corroborated with Kotlikoff on several research projects over the years. Gokhale had been one of Kotlikoff's graduate students. Both economists were excited by the chance to combine Kotlikoff's cutting-edge economic thinking with government policy. If President Bush published their findings in his 2004 budget, it would be the first time that an administration acknowledged how big the fiscal problem facing our nation really was, and it would also be the first step toward a solution. Using the basic principles of Kotlikoff's generational accounting, they added up everything that the government expects to spend, Social Security benefits, debt service payments, salaries, and so forth, and they did that far into the future, and they put it into today's dollars. Then they added up all of the income that the government expects to earn, taxes, income from government assets, and they did that in the future in today's dollars. To perform the calculations, Smetters and Gokhale had to make certain key assumptions about the rate of growth in government spending, taxes, medical costs, and hundreds of other things. Since they wanted to be as conservative as possible, they took their numbers from the government's own budget. And in one particular case, medical costs, they chose a much more optimistic number, opting for 1% growth above GDP rather than the historical rate of 3%. But even with these off-the-shelf numbers from the government, and then reducing the rate of growth from what it is today to something less than that, the gap between payments and income came in at $44.2 trillion, bare minimum. Now think about that, $44 trillion for a moment. It's probably the biggest thing you've ever heard of, and certainly the biggest number that Fortune will publish in its pages this year. It's more than 4 times the size of our gross domestic product and 1.5 times the size of the entire world's gross domestic product. Did you get that? It's 1.5 times the size of the entire world GDP. If we had a fire sale, and we sold all of our nation's assets today, stocks, bonds, real estate, we could just about pull in $44 trillion. Did you hear that, boys and girls? If we went out today and sold everything in America, we might be able to net $44 trillion. Imagine that. You've got a debt over here, not total debts, just one debt, Medicare, Social Security. And you put those two, add them all up, it totals $44 trillion. Now just imagine your household budget. You've got one bill, not all your bills, just one, say the mortgage on your house, that equals 4 times the amount that you're going to earn over the next 4 years. Well, that's the hole that we're in. Now, just to be clear, that number is not a bill that comes due on a certain date. What it shows is the debt that would accumulate over years of deficits if we continue as we are. It's an honest measure of the inexorable pressure on the government's future ability to spend. This amounts to a massive weight on the economy. It's worse than that. It's getting even bigger. You see, every year that the government sits on its hands and does nothing, that $44 trillion grows by about $1.6 trillion a year. Now remember, Kotlikoff's generational accounting technique estimates the present value of our future needs. It's exactly like saving for retirement. The later you start, the more you have to save each year. So if nothing is done this year, the gap will widen to $46 trillion next year. Worse still, Smetters and Gokhale's numbers may be on the low side. When you take another look at how important the assumption about medical costs is, what Smetters and Gokhale discovered was that the two biggest factors making up the $44 trillion black hole were Medicare and Social Security. If they assumed a growth rate above the GDP for medical costs of 1.5% instead of 1% they used in their calculations, that $44 trillion gap would become $65 trillion. Now, there have been some other estimates that I've seen that estimate that the gap is above $65 trillion. You see, it isn't something that's already been accumulated. It's something that we can see coming out in the future. It's kind of like starting off with a jar full of beans, and the jar is full, and you take out two beans, and you put one back. You take out two beans, and you put one back. You take out two beans, you put one back. You know, you don't have to be a mathematical genius to figure out that at some indefinite time in the future, depending upon how fast each one of these bean transactions takes place, that jar is going to become empty at some point in time. And that's where we are here. Now, the Democrats, I heard a guy on TV the other day, he was on McNeil Lair, I think it was, Lair News Hour, and he said, you know, the Republicans are blowing this all out of proportion. You see, Social Security, just the way it's running right now, can run for several decades before there's a crisis. Now, you know, I'm a businessman, and I sat there and I listened to this fool. He's an academician, you know, and that's why I say that academians, by and large, are all fools. By and large, there's some exceptions. If the thing is going to go bankrupt in 5 decades, well, then it's a bankrupt Ponzi scheme, and it needs to be fixed, and the sooner you fix it, the better. I mean, any businessman would come to that conclusion. Now, of course, if you've been to college, college people don't make payrolls. College people don't live under the pressures of the real world. They live out in an ivory tower with tenured positions. You know, they can't be fired. They can't lose their jobs. There's never any threat to them. And so they see the world in a different light than those of us that are out here in the business world producing a product for the marketplace like buggy whips. And one day somebody invents an automobile and puts our business, buggy whips, out of business. They don't have to face that. Business and the products and services that business provides change constantly. There's this constant change. And we have to adapt to that. And when Congress enacts bills and legislation and taxes, we have to pay those. And we have to figure out how we can get our customers to pay higher prices, to pay those higher taxes. Academians don't need to do that. Academians, in short, never have to face the day-to-day problems that come up in the real world. They don't live in the real world. On the other side of the argument was a guy that said Social Security is in crisis and it needs to be solved now. Well, that may be an exaggeration too, because when we listen to politicians and policemen and people talking, you know, they're trying to sell us something, and so they need a crisis to get us willing to pay these higher taxes or to take these actions, kind of like 9/11. You need a crisis like 9/11 to get people to subscribe to the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. You couldn't pass those without a crisis. And so politicians create crises so that they can sell us a program. So the Democrat says, well, there's no problem, or at least if there is a problem, it won't manifest itself for decades in the future. Well, listen, the numbers that I'm citing here from these economists say that the problem becomes acute. Dick Armey was on the other night, and I think he was on McNeil there, or Tucker Carlson or somebody, and he was talking about 2018. He said, no, there is no trust fund in Social Security, and that's what my research has told me. There's no money in Social Security. It is true that Social Security does collect more than it's spending, and then that surplus of about $100 billion a year is spent in the general fund, and then an IOU is put over in the Social Security account. No real money, just an IOU. Kind of like, you know, you bring your paycheck home, and then you've got a little slush fund there in the cookie jar. Now, in your cookie jar, let's say that your wife is selling eggs, and she's putting her egg money in the cookie jar. Now, that cookie jar is building up at about $50 a month. Maybe this has been going on for a year, and she's got $600 in the cookie jar. Now, you're spending your $1,000 a month income. In fact, you're spending about $1,200 a month out of your $1,000 a month income. And so you come in, and you take the $600 out of the cookie jar, and you put an IOU in there. And then you kid yourself that you've still got the same $600 in your cookie jar. No, the real money is gone, and you've got an IOU in there that has to be paid out of your income, which you're not able to live within. Academians, You know, they see that, and that's all right with them. They don't see any problem. And then your businessman looks at that and says, you people are insane. You get your head up the wrong end. So it's a matter of perspective. You know, businessmen see the world differently than academians. And Social Security was put together by college professors and academians and politicians, people that don't really live out here in the real world. They don't pay the taxes. They collect and spend the taxes. That's a hell of a difference now between collecting and spending and working, earning, and paying, let me tell you. So this deficit is getting bigger every year by $1.6 trillion every year that you don't act on it. And the bright spot of all this is that George Bush, our president, wants to take it on and solve the problem. I don't know how he's going to do that. And I haven't seen any specifics. He said something about you take a portion of that 16% that you're paying in, or 15%, and you're going to get that, and you can invest that any way you want. Now, I haven't seen any specifics. I've heard some comments that say it's going to cost $2 trillion to make the transition. I don't know where that $2 trillion is going to come from or how that's going to impact upon the economy. I don't know the specifics of it. I admire the president for wanting to take action. You know, action needed to have been taken a long time ago, starting about 1951 when they started at 2.25% and said, we got to have more money. You see, Social Security, when it began back in the 1930s, paid out its first check in 1940. And there were 80 people paying in for everybody drawing out in 1940, 45 to 1 in 1945. 16 to 1 in 1957, 3.2 to 1 in 1998. It's 2 to 1 today, and it's headed toward 1 to 1. Now, the tax has moved up from 1% to 16% at the same time. Now, doesn't that tell you that that's a bankrupt Ponzi scheme and that it cannot continue? I mean, even if you're public school educated, you know, you don't have to be too bright to put those two converging graphs together, now, do you? You've moved from 80 people paying in or 16 people paying in for everybody drawn out, until it's down to two people paying in and one person drawn out. Now, you see, if Social Security were working the other way, if this year you said, well, there's 16 people paying in for everybody drawing out, next year there'll be 17 paying in for everyone drawing out, and then 18 to 1 and 19 to 1, you'd say, well, this thing is not only fiscally solvent, this thing is profitable, and over the long haul, it's going to have so much money in there, we'll be able to raise benefits and be able to fund it all. But that's not what's going on. Furthermore, when the tax started out at 1% and it grew to 2% and 5%, and now it's up to 15 or 16%, and now they're telling you the thing's going broke again and they're going to have to raise taxes or cut benefits, it's a double whammy. Not only don't you have enough people entering the workforce, you've got more people retiring than are going into the workforce. Now, at some point in time, no matter what your opinion of Social Security is, there's coming a time with these trends on the graphs, unless it can be halted and then reverse, you're going to end up in some fashion at some point in time in the future, like the beans that you're taking out of the jar, there isn't going to be anything in it. And when you get to 1 to 1, then the reverse of that is there'll be one person paying in and two people drawing out, and then one person paying in and four persons drawing out, and then one person paying in and eight people drawing out. And you know, I don't care what your opinion is, at some point in time you physically are not going to have enough strength in your body to support 4, 8, 16, 32, or 64 other people all by yourself. Now, it's a lot easier for 16 people to support one person than it is for one person to support 16. And that's where we're headed. So when I listen to this Democratic academician getting up there saying, you know, there's no crisis, there's no problem, and then I read these numbers, and these aren't the only numbers I've read. You know, I get these reports from a number of other sources, and the Bible tells me that at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall the matter be established, and these numbers come from the U.S. government. So the government is printing the numbers that are describing the size, the scope, and the time frame of the looming crisis. So if it's not a crisis today, I guess it'll be a crisis in 2018 or 2032, but if it's growing at the rate of $1.6 trillion a year, don't you think that if we were to attack it and solve the problem this year, that we could save $1.6 trillion? And wouldn't that money be better spent on these retirement benefits than it would be on the debt? I mean, I just throw that out for your consideration. Well, let me tell you a little story here before we go any further. We're at about the halfway point in today's programs. Keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website at georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School Direct, 417-273-4967. Be sure to call and order your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, they go on. After O'Neill was fired, this is Paul O'Neill now. Remember, he was the Secretary of the Treasury, and I kind of wondered what it was that got him fired. Well, it was the Social Security trip. You know, he said to George Bush, the president, he says, hey, we got a real problem here, and I've ordered a study. Here's the study. Let's publish it and tell the American people what the problem is. And George Bush said, no, we're not going to do that. We're running for re-election. We can't run out here and tell these people what the real state of the economy is or the real state of our economic circumstances. That isn't going to be very nice. Now, keep in mind that presidents go out and they present a budget to Congress. You know, in the State of the Union message, the president now is going to present his budget to Congress, his proposed spending program. And if the economy does well, the president gets credit for it. And if the economy does poorly, then he gets blamed for it. But presidents don't make these economic decisions. The economy is not run by the Republicans or Democrats or by the president or the Congress. The economy is run by the Committee of 300. Who in turn run that down through the think tanks and through the various and sundry domestic organizations and corporations and institutions, and they all have their inputs. Now, the president over here gets the credit or he gets the blame, but he's not the guy that makes the decisions. And that's just where reality is at, and it's been that way, you know, for generations now, so it's not anything that's new. Bill Clinton got credit for the economy of the 1990s. The events that produced the economy of the 1990s were put in place by the Bush administration before Clinton was elected, but they hadn't taken effect yet. So the people said, well, we're tired of this, so they voted Bush out and Clinton in. Clinton gets the benefits of the economic changes that were made in the Bush years, but George Bush Jr. here, no blame him for the recession that we've been going through because that began in March of 2000 under Clinton. But don't blame Clinton. He didn't create it either. Now, Social Security didn't come from Franklin D. Roosevelt. It came from the Committee of 300. The New World Order doesn't come from the politicians. It comes from the powers that be, the international bankers and the various and sundry organizations that make up the Committee of 300 that are directing the world on the course that it's been on for the last 200 years, headed toward this one world super national government. And so the question arises, well, okay, I'm not going to change that. George Gordon isn't going to elect or defeat some political office, isn't going to change the IRS or the FBI or the Patriot Act. I have to figure out, well, how am I and my family going to live through this? How am I going to get the most bang for the buck for me personally? And I guess all the rest of you are in the same boat. So I'm sitting here watching Social Security. I'm a little bit different in that I don't have a Social Security account. I haven't for 20 years. I don't pay into it. I'm old enough to draw out of it. Of course, I'm not entitled to anything because I didn't pay in. So why should I draw anything out? So I'm not concerned about Social Security. I'm not retired. I'm not going to retire. I'm going to work until I die. That's what Americans used to do in this country before Social Security came along. We worked until we died. We didn't retire. Retirement is not something that you find in the Bible. It isn't something that God ordained through Moses. It isn't the 11th commandment that at age 65, thou shalt retire on Social Security. It's a socialist idea, it's a socialist program, it appeals to people because the innate human function, that is human nature, we're just basically lazy, we don't want to work. So we came up with a plan to transfer the wealth of the young to the pockets of the elderly. So we have an income transfer program using the police powers of the state. And Paul O'Neill pointed that out to Tucker Carlson, that it's a coercive theft of the labor of the young people in the country, transferring it to the old people of the country in a chain letter Ponzi scheme in which the young people are not going to get what's been promised to them under this program. So now if you're under 40 years old, you're not going to get what you're paying in. I'll give you the numbers a little later on. Paul O'Neill pointed that out, and after O'Neill was fired, Smetters and Gokhale were left holding a controversial report that they had thought was supported by the highest level of government. And once it was clear that their work would never go anywhere in the Treasury Department, they published their findings in a conservative journal put out by the American Enterprise Institute and then returned to their pre-Treasury employers. Now, Smetters is back at the University of Pennsylvania. Gokhale is at the Cleveland Federal Reserve. Now, there's a rare consensus among economists regarding the wisdom of generational accounting, but some, notably Harvard economist Martin Feldstein, see the problem as just that. It's a problem, not an apocalypse. Feldstein was Kotlikoff's dissertation advisor and remains a close friend. He wields considerable influence with the current administration and has seen many of his ideas incorporated into its fiscal policy. Now, here comes academia. What Larry has done is to say, what happens if we don't do anything to fill the gap? Feldstein explains, that's not what will happen. Either we will raise taxes, or we will cut benefits, or we will change the way that we finance the system, or it will be some combination of all three. Feldstein points to President Bush's policy and his proposal to privatize Social Security as evidence that the government is committed to dealing with the problem. So here's an academician, Feldstein. He says, well, we can raise taxes, okay, or we can cut benefits, okay, or we can do some combination thereof, raising taxes, cutting benefits, or changing the way the system is financed, which is what President Bush is now proposing. What's this going to cost? How's it going to be financed? Those are some details that we haven't seen yet. Now, a fool answers the matter before he's heard the whole matter, so it's premature to rail or ridicule or to deny President Bush's proposal. Something has to be done at some point in time. Democrats say it doesn't have to be done yet. We can wait. The Republicans say we need to act now. There's a crisis. And maybe somewhere in between is where the truth lies. Now, going on, he says, that may be, but it will require a great deal more courage than any politician has shown so far. And in their report, Smetters and Gokhale calculate that it would take a 69% hike in all federal taxes or a 95% hike in payroll taxes to close the $44 trillion gap. Or if you prefer spending cuts, a 100% plus cut across the discretionary federal spending, which of course is impossible, or a 45% cut to Social Security and Medicare. Solving this problem is going to hurt like hell. All right? Well, you know, in the business world, when we're faced with a problem like this, let's suppose that you're running a waterbed furniture manufacturing company and your sales drop off 10%. Well, then we have to cut production by 10%. We have to cut the payroll by 10%. We have to cut our cost of goods sold by 10%. That's all. So we lay off a few people and we don't buy as much raw materials, and then we turn out 10% fewer beds. No problem there. And you can do the same thing with Medicare. I mean, you know, you can simply cut back 45%. If you're short 45% in the business world, we have to cut spending 45%. Government doesn't. What government does is they maintain their spending irrespective of their income. That's because they can print up more money. They can't make more gold, but they can print up more money. That's why we had to get rid of gold. Gold is an impediment to deficit spending. So we solved that problem by creating a Federal Reserve Bank, eliminating specie or hard currency, hard money, and now we've gone to fiat currency. We can just print more. Okay, now, the other day, some Harvard people, that's these smart people that go to college, they came to a conclusion that you couldn't live on the current minimum wage of $5 an hour, $5 and some change. And they said you got to have $8.25 an hour to make ends meet. Now, I thought that was a little bit presumptuous, because Mexicans come up here from Mexico, and they go to work for $5 an hour and change, send half of their money home, they live better than they did in Mexico, and they seem to be happy as a clam at high tide, and there's 2,000 a day that want to come in here and do the same thing. You know, it's all a matter of perspective. It is true that Americans don't want to work for $5 an hour, and they want $8 an hour. Now, let's raise the minimum wage to $8 an hour. What's that going to do to a Big Mac? What's that going to do to the price of a hotel room? There's no problem here. The businessman simply says, okay, the government says that we have to pay all of you employees today $5 an hour. Next week, they're going to raise that to $8. So therefore, my labor bill is going up by 60%. So since my labor bill is going up, I'm going to raise the price of a room by $5 a night, whatever that reflects in the room price. So if tonight the price of a room is $35, next week it's going to be $40 a night. That's all. We call that inflation. Now, you and I have to rent those motel rooms, and so we notice that the price of motel rooms has gone up by $5 a night, and so we got to have more money, and so we raise our prices, and these price rises ripple through the economy. Now, whatever it was that these poor people at $5 an hour couldn't buy, for which they needed another $3 an hour, which they now have, is more than offset by the price rises that go through the economy. And then they'll say, well, you can't live on $8 an hour. So now you're going to have 10 or 15 or some other new number, some other new higher number, and we go through this cycle again and again and again. Now, you know, as a businessman, I sit here and say, well, wouldn't it make more sense? If we just lived within our income and we didn't print all of this fiat currency, balanced our budget, and just lived within what we make. As I said, you know, a Mexican can come up here from Mexico and he works for $5 an hour and he sends half of it home, so he saves half. He lives at a lesser standard of living. Has it occurred to Americans that maybe we need to live at a lesser standard of living? No, it hasn't. And so over the last 70 years, we haven't lived within our budget, within our means, and so we have consistently borrowed more, and now we're a nation of net consumers and borrowers rather than net savers and producers. Does that have a consequence? Is there ever a point in time when there's a comeuppance that says, well, things are going to get changed, and they'll get changed for the worse? Now, in the real world where I'm from, if we did that, we wouldn't be able to meet our payroll and we would be put out of business. We wouldn't be able to pay our suppliers and they wouldn't sell us any more raw materials. We wouldn't be able to make and sell our products and we would be put out of business. Argentina was put out of business a few years back. And they still got massive unemployment and massive dislocations and great losses of private property down there in Argentina. It's been going on in other countries around the world that have indulged in hyperinflation, fiat currencies, and budget deficits. I think that the same thing is going to happen here, and I would suggest that the sooner we take action, then the better we're going to weather the storm. Now, it's just George Gordon's opinion. But, you know, if the poo fits, wear it. So what about economic growth? Can't that help reduce our debt? Well, Kotlikoff shakes his head again. Growth, in fact, he said, makes this particular problem worse, because when the economy grows faster, so does Social Security and Medicare. See, we have a progressive income tax in this country. We got progressive taxes. Second plank to the Communist Manifesto. So the faster you grow the economy, the faster you grow your taxes. And that was what President Reagan said. He said, if we can grow the economy, we will get more money. President Bush has put that into practice. You lower the taxes, and the Democrats are just loath to lower taxes. And I'm just telling you, I got taxed to such a point that I just closed my company, said to hell with it. Now, tax rates have come down pretty dramatically. I could go back into the business world. I'm not going to, but I could go back into the business world. I could probably make it. So President Bush did the right thing when he lowered taxes. You see, the higher taxes get, remember the ad that I gave you a little while ago? If you're making $50,000 a year and the government leaves you with $20,000, as a wage earner, you might sit there and say, well, I don't have any choice. I got to go back out there and work for what I can get. But as a businessman, when I go out and invest $50,000 and the government takes $30,000 and leaves me with $20,000, it just sends a signal to me. It says, well, I don't think I want to invest that. Let me give you an illustration. I was toying with the idea of putting in a solar power plant here at the farm. I had a student come here, and he told me about the costs. And I said, well, gee, if the costs are what you tell me they are, I think I'll put in a solar power plant because it'll pay for itself with about an 8% return over the next 20 years. And while that's not a great return, it's respectable. It's a little higher than inflation, and then I would be off the grid. So we got into it, and when we got into it, we found out that the total cost for what we need here is $50,000. And when we took a look at what the power company delivers power for, it's $2,500 a year. So $2,500 a year for 20 years means that we'll just break even after 20 years. So I can do nothing. I can keep my $50,000 in my pocket and invest it in other things over the next 20 years, or I can spend it and put in a power plant. If I spend it and put in the power plant, I'm going to get my $50,000 back after 20 years. So I got to work hard to break even. I can keep the $50,000, take $2,500 of it and pay my power bill, take the $47,500 and invest it. How much do you think I could make off of my $47,500 in 1 year of buying, selling, and trading cattle, sheep, land, or something else? Well, I would shoot for doubling it. So I think I could take that same $50,000 and double it in 1 year, just buying, and selling, and trading, and then pay the power company to deliver the power, and I don't have to work or invest and then wonder if I'm going to get my money back. And so that's what business is all about. Government and academians don't have to, and they don't think about how to invest and how to make money. I'll show you as we progress along that if you took the amount of money that you're putting into Social Security and you just put it into U.S. government bonds, you'd be a multimillionaire in 40 or 45 years when you go to retire in today's dollars. And anybody can do that. I mean, you don't have to be smart to just take the Social Security withholding tax every week. I mean, the government could do this. They could say, we're gonna finance Social Security a little differently. And here's the way we're going to do it. We'll finance Social Security by just forcing you to take your money and invest it in U.S. Treasury bills at 5% interest for the next 45 years. I mean, if they can take your money and pass it on to another class of people, they could take your same money and invest it in those same government bonds that every year you have to pay your taxes to pay the interest on. Couldn't they? And you'd have several million dollars when you got through with the program. So economic growth isn't going to solve the problem. One aspect of this problem that everyone agrees on is that it is so huge that no single segment of society can bear it alone. It's going to be felt across the board by all Americans. 77 million baby boomers are going to start retiring in 5 years' time. As they retire, the number of retirees in America are going to double. At the same time, the workforce supporting them will grow by 15%. So we're going to double the number of retirees, and we're going to increase the number of people going into the workforce by 15%. So you got 50 million people today drawing Social Security, and you're going to double that to 100 million. You got 100 million people in the workforce who are in there working, and you're going to increase that to 115 million. See where you're going? You're going to have one person paying in and one person drawing out. Well, that isn't going to work very well, is it? I mean, in 1998, you had 3.2. I think it may be around that now. 3.2 people paying in for everybody drawing out. What do you think it's going to be like when it goes to 1-to-1? And then it'll be 1 to 2 and 1 to 4 and 1 to 8 and 1 to 16. You know, as you just extrapolate that out into the future. So when the Republicans say that we're facing a crisis over here, I don't know if the crisis is upon us in 2005 or not, but it looks like to me that Social Security is going to collapse at some indefinite time in the future. Now, the longer you talk to Kotlikoff about this subject, the more dramatic his rhetoric becomes. We're setting our kids up for a great fall, Kotlikoff says bitterly. We were left with a much better situation than our parents and their parents before them. It's the American dream, but instead, we're leaving our children with a fiscal crisis. And he's particularly critical of the Bush administration and believes that he has made matters worse by cutting taxes by so much and then increasing spending so sharply. For instance, he points to President Bush's proposed prescription drug benefit. The Democrats also backed that, which could cost between $400 billion and a trillion over the next 10 years. And by his reckoning, that raises the $44 trillion fiscal gap by another $6 trillion. And the way Kotlikoff sees it, we're heading for a crisis with no escape. And he believes that one day, financial markets will wake up to the size of the problem and send interest rates through the roof. And when that happens, the government will be forced to get its house in order. For example, raise taxes and cut benefits. And it will also rely on higher inflation to keep or to help reduce the debt problem. And if that all sounds bad for the economy, well, it will be. And I'm scared, says Kotlikoff, but I don't know what to tell my 13-year-old son. All I can do is try to save more. But what can you leave your children that will not be eaten up by taxes and inflation? It's clear nobody can solve a $44 trillion size problem overnight. Yet in Washington, generational accounting is as popular as a skunk at a garden party. And the real question is, do we continue an eyes wide shut fiscal policy or, and this is a huge or, admit that there's something really big and ugly staring us in the face? Well, I looked at this big, ugly, staring me in the face some years ago, and I said, you know, this thing is a nowheresville, so I think I'll get out. So I got out of the damn thing back in 84. There are 14 million people in this country that aren't participating in Social Security. So if you think that everybody has Social Security and it's the law and you've got to have it, that's a fiction. If you think the government can solve the Social Security problem and you're hoping that that will be the answer, well, that's your choice. I don't think that this thing is solvable, and Paul O'Neill said so. He was the Secretary of the Treasury. You're faced here with an insoluble problem. That's the bottom line. All right, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll be back. Social Security when we return tomorrow night. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, there's a signal that says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.